is the Embark Pod, a series by Embark Group, bringing together industry leaders and commentators to discuss and debate the future of the industry. And today, very pleased to say we have Embark's Chief Investment Officer, and a familiar voice on this podcast too, Peter Toogood. Peter, welcome. Thanks for being with us once again.
Hello there, Roger.
Now today, Peter, we're going to be asking you, what can the tech crash teach us about value versus growth investing strategies in 2023. Now, we do know, obviously, that historically well-performing tech stocks are experiencing, well, let's call it turmoil. Big tech firms battered by regulation, staffing cuts, and especially here in the UK, privacy and online security pressures as well. Heavyweights like Tesla, Google, Meta, all hurting. So the big question is this a short-term phenomenon, or are we witnessing a longer trend, and how are the macroeconomic factors behind this going to hit other stocks, such as commodities, for example? That's what we're talking about today. So, Peter, let's dive in. Is the turmoil, in your view, in tech stocks a short-term phenomenon, or is it the beginning of a long-term downturn in the industry?
No, it's a measure of how ridiculously expensive they got in the summer 2 years ago. I think was as Amazon was on 180 times earnings, to remind anyone listening to this, that's 180 years of discounted earnings. Utter lunacy. And that is where we got to. Peg ratios of four. So you're paying four times the growth rate of these companies. Plus, you know, if Amazon's doing 40% earnings a year, you were paying four times that. I mean, it's just insane, utterly insane. And you paid the price for a very similar phenomenon to 2000. I'm old enough to have been there as well, running money in that era, and it was no different. The Sun Microsystems moment of, why are you paying 10 times price to sales for my company? I don't understand. At least he was an honest CEO, I guess. And that's been the challenge. I think a lot of the rhetoric around the FANGs was really, as much as anything else, they got absurdly expensive. Now, some of them also have arguably operational challenges, and perhaps Facebook / Meta falls mostly into that category as it metamorphizes its business. But a lot of it was just an intense level of overvaluation, largely, I would say, prompted by COVID in some respects, because obviously the stay-at-home phenomenon, the shift to the likes of Netflix, for example, in terms of streaming, etc., exaggerated by the COVID impact. And then the likes of Tesla being an absolute leader, for example, in electric cars, but simply ridiculous when it's the entire market cap of every other single car company in the world at one point, which is obviously ridiculous. It doesn't make Tesla a bad company. It just means it was the wrong price.
So lessons to learn, I guess, as far as investors are concerned, from that overvaluation. And one thinks, I suppose, of other tech stocks that haven't yet played out that way. I mean, unicorns like Uber haven't yet turned a profit. I mean,
in their perspectives, Roger, in their perspectives, they said they might not, which I always thought was quite entertaining. I believe Uber's prospectus said we may not make a profit.
Yeah, and I mean, in that sense, then, do you, as an investor, look at that and say, well, that we have to take on board and indeed apply those lessons to lots of others as well? You know, overvaluation is the mega problem, it seems to me, is what you're saying.
Well, you spend, since the GFC, you have transplanted private sector debt into government debt is the upshot. You've also added more private debt as well. But if you think the private sector was in trouble in 08, that's what it was about. It's about transferring that onto government balance sheets through a combination of QE and, of course, keeping interest rates extremely low. You also therefore created free money. You created a cost of capital that was precisely zero, which allowed people to start believing in the idea that any kind of business plan of any sort whatsoever was had absolutely no cost of capital discipline. You didn't have to have a return on the project. People will come up with things like, oh, we'll have another million eyeballs this time next year, therefore keep funding my business. Fintech's a good example of all those things. Promises made on the back of free money, none of which was real. And I can sit here saying that because I know you and I are having chats. I think I was actually on Blue, I think on a certain channel with you. I think
you certainly were.
I was screaming the odds on where the FANGs were. And I said, they're going to halve. And by the way, they actually halved. And I think that's just evaluation discipline, Roger. It's just reminding yourself. Tesla is a good company. It's created a fantastic franchise, not just in cars, in other things, in satellites, all sorts of other things. Musk may not be everyone's To everyone's taste, but he is a minor genius, isn't he, in the way he thinks about the business. And the fact is, those cars cost a lot less to produce than the mainstream combustion engine cars. And that's why he's having fun with pricing points now on his cars, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a good business franchise. Is Amazon a good business franchise? Yes, potentially, of course, it remains a leader in its field. But again, it got extremely expensive. Does Facebook or Meta have operational issues? Yes, it does. Are those things worth analysing? Yes, they are. Has the peak in FANG happened? Yes, in terms of their likely price point as a multiple of their earnings. Yes, doesn't mean the price can't go up over time in share price terms. But certainly that was the nadir for those particular stocks. And it was also the nadir for the profitless prosperity stocks. So those that relied simply on funding to try and break into their marketplace. Again, Roger, you and I are old enough to remember the reminiscences of here's my business plan to take on Unilever in 1999, which was three pages long. And that was the kind of nonsense going around then. And we've actually just repeated it, by the way. I mean, you know, history was it doesn't match, but it rhymes. And we've just had almost, for me, and I think probably for you, what was an almost press play repeat. Incredibly so, in fact, in many ways. Profitless businesses, no chance of whatsoever of any making any headway. And they've exploded. And personally, I couldn't be happier because it's all nonsense. It's a cost of capital has been reasserted. Interest rates have gone up. Companies need to generate a return, work out what the return is going to be on any investments they're making or indeed on their existing assets. And that means that the world becomes normal.
Yeah, balloons and bubbles, particularly balloons at the moment, I guess, bursting, and we can hear that and we can see it. So I suppose the point then, Peter, is to stand back and say, well, what do we learn? What can we do in terms of policy generally as investors? Because always keen for returns to get as high as possible, of course. Advisors need to communicate strategy to them in these sort of areas. I mean, we're talking agility and high-risk strategies, of course, what we have been talking about, or is it go back to the Buffett style of investing, long-term growth? That's where we need to be. How do we play this?
Well, that's always interesting, isn't it? Buffett long-term investing. He's got $180 billion in cash. My favourite is always that Buffett cited as the long-term investor. Yeah, when the price comes along for him to buy stuff. So if he's, and I always think that misrepresentation of Buffett is invested long term. Yeah, he's invested in things he wants to buy long term at the right price point. That's not the same as being fully invested all the time, which is, I think, myth number one about how the greatest investors in the world, because they buy when it's the right price. And I think that's the message from this last three or four, and actually I'd say almost from 2008. If you think about it, Roger, September last year, the credit markets have given up all the gains they've made since 08. So the actual yield plus spread on an investment grade bond was right back to where it was in September 08. October 08. That's quite something.
That is staggering, actually, as we think about it. Really.
Well, it's actually 14 years of a policy that basically didn't work. If you think about it, if you consider not working, meaning the yield appeared to be the same 14 years later, you could argue that QE wasn't that successful ultimately, perhaps, discussed by the way. So what it has done, however, is mean that yields are in a different zone in terms of their price point. Maybe it was 1 to 2, maybe we're now 3 to 5. I'd argue you can even overshoot higher than that. Why this all matters is because it means there's a real cost to companies now doing business if they want to borrow. That means that the kind of businesses you want to own, the ones that can sweat assets they may already have, or in a position to make projects work when they are profitable, when they apply a profitable cost of capital. That means the businesses have to be real ones, not made up ones, first of all. So blue sky, bye-bye, good luck with that. And then number two, it's probably a little bit of the whole, and I think this is the sort of embedded conversation we're going to have about growth and value, is it's going to be the kind of companies going to exploit their market position, are probably well-funded, know how to actually execute on new projects, know how to run the existing business. And so that sort of the whole debate of growth and value becomes a bit amorphous because I could, you know, I'll ask you, is Jet2.com a growth business? Is EasyJet a good growth business? Yeah. Is Ryanair a growth business? Is Next a growth business? My response would be yes, because they've got a good high return on equity. So this whole argument, growth and value, got distorted by the idea that you can buy growth. You can buy growth with cheap money. Was nonsense, is nonsense, remains nonsense, he says at the tender age of 56, having learned that lesson for the last 35 years. That is why the growth value debate becomes spurious for the next few years, and why you're going to hear me say this again, probably for the first time in a long time. It should be the right environment for stock picking.
Right.
And that means that a certain bank will do better than another bank, or a certain chemical company better than another chemical company, or a certain airline may do better than another airline. And you'll have to work out whether you want to own Ryanair, Jet2, IAG, whatever it might be, if I'm just using UK examples. And that's, I think, where we've landed. And simply put, it's because the cost of capital is materially higher and is very likely to stay materially higher. And you will not have this flood of money, floodgates of nonsense, where businesses are being equity funded to try and pretend that they can overnight. Good example, Cazoo. Let's use the great example of how you can't beat up a franchise. Look at used cars and cars. Cazoo comes along, Carvana in the US. They've both failed. They failed miserably to take any chance of taking away from the dealers. And we can spend hours on why the car dealers are fine, well ensconced, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it just didn't work. And that's the brutal truth. And that's why growth investing has been hijacked by this. We can disrupt every business. No, you can't.
That's a line to take away. But I mean, the point then, I suppose, is that advisors, investment officers like yourself have to work that bit hard. I'm sure you work very hard anyway. But in just saying there
no,
are...
No, never, strength. Roger, never. Never not me, sir.
but there's not sort of a big thing. You think, oh, this is the next big thing. It's, as you say, stock picking in a much more granular way, perhaps.
Well, I think it's also some of the legacy stuff. So you end up, perhaps the banks are more interesting. You know, they're going to earn a far higher return on equity on their assets, aren't they? Imagine trying to make money when interest rates were nearly zero, or zero in the case of some markets. Japanese banks being a good example of how not to be in a banking industry. You can't make any turn, can you? You just can't. You're not making any money on the assets you actually have. You're not lending to anyone either. That's the definition of a nightmare. Nowadays, you're going to have a very different situation where there is a real cost to equity. There is also, therefore, the corollary of that is if you're a bank, you can sweat your assets far better and you're going to earn far better margins. So there's an example of why the higher interest rate, higher inflation world, which we are probably in, is more beneficial to that particular sector. Energy is another one. I know it's not going to go down well with all those that are thinking about things related to the transitioning, but the likes of Shell can now operate on $40 oil because they've shaped up their businesses so well. That's what they can now do. That's a heck of a long way from where they were 5 years ago. It was probably nearer to $60, maybe even $80 before they could make a profit. So that's the kind of way you need to think about it. It's going to be the kind of neglected sectors that have not done so well. But within that, that's also, it doesn't exclude other areas. You know, it's probably the cash flow is king thing, yes, but at the right price, i.e. perhaps a bank, not Diageo. Diageo's dividend yield is what, 2.5? Is it fully priced? Probably now. That kind of example. I think that's a very good working example I can give. In fact, I happen very conveniently to have some numbers here.
Go on,
which,
then.
Numbers I know are never fantastic for individuals to listen to, but these are so basic in terms of the way I can put them across, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And let me just get to them. And here we are. So Diageo is a great example. It's P/E 16 times, 21 times. In 12 years ago, it was 15 times. Its dividend yield 15 years ago was 3.4. It's now 2.2. Its free cash flow yield was just over 6 12 years ago. It's now 3. That's what I call a fully re-rated defensive company. Okay, here's Shell. PE was 7. It's now 5. Dividend yield was 4.8. It's now 4.1. Its cash flow yield was 6.3 in January 11. It's now 16.5. So let's put it another way. Shell can buy itself back in 5 years. Right. That's what's changed. That's what's interesting. And that's what's exciting people. That is the reality of where we are. HSBC, one other good example. PE was 12 years ago. It's now 6. Dividend yield was 3.8. It's now 8. HSBC's dividend yield is 8%. My word. That's amazing. And that's the change we're discussing.
Yeah,
that's
we're
discussing.
I suppose the point in this, Peter, is also, you know, it's good to hear, you know, some of these older industries, you know, things we've now got used to in various ways, ups and downs, you're saying that's where to look. But there must be some new trend. There must be some new stuff out there, which, you know, okay, may not be this this cloud cuckoo land stuff, which we've been talking about that caused so many problems with overvaluation, but things that we can look to, perhaps for some of your younger investment officers, I don't know whether age is a factor in this, who know what's coming around the corner and can see this as somewhere to go in the longer term future.
From the perspective of new trends, that's also an interesting question, Roger, to the extent that the trend was very clearly tech for a period of time. And the question that is arising in meetings, particularly this year so far, is how you apply technology. So the winning companies are those that can take advantage of technology rather than the social media platform world we've been in, the streaming world, etc. It's those that can turn technology to their advantage. Digitizing their business more effectively is a very basic but extremely good example of productivity and efficiency and market reach. So that trend is going to apply to a lot of things. We hear about transport companies with better logistics because of applying technology. It's that sort of thing. It's not going to be as simple as I buy energy, I buy banks, I buy tech, or I don't buy any of the above. It's not, tech is not going to be the automatic winner. The market cap weight is of a certain level, but it's a world in which you probably don't want to be quite so dogmatic about the fact that tech is a win-win-win. It isn't a win-win-win. What is probably the next decade is about the application of technology, if you like, the nuts and bolts of it, as distinct from picking on Amazon and saying it will be the only retailer left in the world by 2050, which is broadly what the market cap was telling you, and that Tesla would be the only car company left by 2050, none of which is actually true.
So the application, for example, of AI to something like a haulage business AI, or something like that kind of
absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're going to be looking at, and what fund manager. The resonating commentary that we are receiving from this year to date so far is very much the world of stock pick. I don't just sit there blindly being broadly overweight tech. Let's be honest, if you're in the US, it's growth. That's why the UK is such a struggle. What is tech in the UK? What is it? I mean, that is the other problem. What is it? Arm that's going to the US anyway and not much else. So one of the other reasons certain other markets have struggled. I mean, the old line is that the UK is made up of miners, healthcare stocks, really, and energy companies. And the European markets are made up of consumer brands. It's a bit glib, but it's not far off. And so the other interesting aspect to it is when I talk about where you allocate all the global equity managers, doesn't matter if they're growth value or anything in between, they all talk about how it is definitely the US and Asia that creates the interesting opportunities. And that's to a degree the UK, Europe and others are struggling. So even within the growth and value conversation, you can have a conversation about the fact that the US is only in a free cash flow yield of 5%, very lowly rated. Yet the UK is 11 times, I think the 11% free cash flow, because the market is on, you know, it's about 10 or 11 percent free cash flow because the market's on 10 times earnings. So the UK is approximately half the value of the US, but there's a good reason for that. Some of that is to do with the nature and scope of the industries within the UK versus the US. But what I'm arguing here is that some of those older industries and legacy businesses, the kind of things that actually the UK is made up of to a degree, are probably going to do very, very well in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years relative to the growth sector. So one of the ways that the rating may close versus the US is that some of those more favoured faddy sectors, if you want to use that phrase, probably derate versus rest of world. It doesn't have to be that tech collapses. It could be just as simple as the rotation back to what, yes, would have been called, Roger, you and I remember this phrase, old industries in 2000, because they were all called old.
Yes, old legacy, all those kind of things.
And legacy, but old and legacy can also make itself smarter and more efficient. And I think that is what we're discussing. And then twin that with the need to do infrastructure, the need to do transition, transitioning of our power supplies, et cetera, et cetera. Equality is still playing into here. That is about how governments are going to fund these things, et cetera, et cetera. That is all very real. And I do think that has an impact potentially on where the disruption will be. The disruption has sort of been within the tech space. Well, there's going to be major disruption in terms of power transmission, energy. That's an interesting area. So thematic, a younger thematic could be something like that. So look at the sustainable energy funds, for example, and what they're doing versus the mainstream energy funds. That's the sort of interesting thematic, robotics and AI, indeed, how you can exploit that given this so limited number of stocks, you can actually apply to that because they're generally within conglomerates, particularly in Japan, rather than specific. So that's it's less tangible to touch and to actually apply. That's more difficult, but it's clearly something that's more, is very relevant for this decade.
You're mentioning energy there, but it kind of brings me on to something. I mean, we'll bring our horizon slightly nearer in. What we have seen, of course, Peter, in the last year and a half has been commodities, the way they've been performing, best performing stock stocks in 2022, obviously. A lot of that comes from the war, from Ukraine, the energy demand being driven and all the rest of it. But just looking at commodities more widely, how do you see that going forward? And I take on board the war that's driving it. Of course, we have no idea where that's going.
No, we don't, except sadly it looks more like a trench warfare, which is depressing for all of us to see, as I'm sure we appreciate. The energy, the mining, the issue is for those companies, they've got far more efficient to, the old thing of spend, spend, spend. Again, Roger, you'll remember the miners used to just like to buy each other all the time, as sort of every 5 to 7 years, the investment banks would come along and facilitate yet another purchase of yet another large company by another large company, all that sort of thing. Not so much in the gold mining, but the other companies, I think that discipline has been learned. Secondarily, the whole constraints required on more efficient production does apply a restriction and makes you think twice probably about CapEx. And in the energy space, it particularly does. Regardless of your view of green or otherwise, we're walking into a potential problem given the absolute absence of CapEx in places, specifically like oil, obviously, is the most obvious example of that. Gas may be plentiful, but only in the US, not particularly anywhere else, unless we're going to make friends with Russia again. So we've got that whole energy security angle, but you've also got a lack of CapEx in that area. So that makes the oil price zero again. I doubt it. I think the lessons were all learned by the participants in the market when the oil price dropped towards zero. So much more capital discipline from those producers. And obviously, there's some of the political effect of people saying, don't open up oil fields, don't find more fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. So there's going to be a working supply constraint in a number of these areas. And of course, obviously, for the likes of copper, well, the transition will require an awful lot of copper. There's no other way around it. So that's a good example of where you're going to be able to exploit the supply-demand imbalance. There probably just is not the imbalance. There is just not the supply potential to deliver a very rapid greening process. And it is up for debate as to how quickly we're all going to decide to do that in the next decade. So again, that plays back into this, where do you take advantage of sustainability? Well, it is partly in that. It's in efficient farming. So that there's an interesting one, isn't there? Agribusinesses, do you dare to go and touch the genomic side, gene, this the side of looking at agriculture and how you can enhance production? Do you dare to go there, et cetera, et cetera? Those are the sort of places that are probably very interesting in the next 5 to 10 years. As the world population is very large, we have to feed it and we have to power it. So that's definitely a theme for the decade, without doubt. And then I'm going to go back to the old playbook of, I think the other thing fund managers are going to have to do is get much used to tucking and trimming, as it used to be called. You will have to take a stock. If it goes up quite a bit, take some of it off the table again. It isn't just buying, as you said a little earlier, Roger, go and buy, 10 of the great and the good, and I'll see you in a decade. That's absolutely over.
Right. Okay. I mean, it's interesting that that sort of policy is doing that, because, I mean, going back to this whole issue with advisors, investors, how we're looking at how to do this, advisors obviously like the idea of riding industry waves. That's kind of how it's gone. What you're saying is that kind of period maybe needs to be revised. I mean, what's a realistic window to expect growth delivered in, value realized? I mean, does all that have to be re-looked at and re-engaged with?
Yes, because the cost of capital has gone up, because the free money is over, because QE is finished, because we've not got a pandemic anymore. And eventually the central bankers are going to stop actually trying to pretend that the wealth effect comes from the stock market. That's a US phenomenon primarily. I mean, I would take as a proxy far more likely look at the rest of the world and see what equity markets have done there. And the truth of the matter is that they've been far more staid, but they're probably much more reflecting the reality we've had, which is we've kept financialising the world. People have more and more debt, and where's that expressed itself most vividly, in housing. So, I mean, if you're going to look at the watchword for a bit of caution, just let's see how the world copes with higher rates of financing for property, because that definitely commercial property is a worrying trend. I would be cautious about that. But I think you have to go back to good old grist and mill fund managers, those that show a good degree of flexibility. They might be called GARP, growth at right price guided managers. They might be on the slight value side of that. They might even be in the modest growth side of that. But I think deep stylistic stuff, maybe value has another run because the banks, energy companies probably carry on doing well for a bit longer. But you're going to need relative value players and relative growth players, all of who are willing to look at the portfolio each day and say, well, that's gone up that much. I trim that and I buy this one. And I think it's just going to be much more of that kind of pragmatic behavior required of fund managers to achieve, and it's not obvious to me that passive investing in the bluntest sense of the word is going to have a great time here, because there's going to be a great deal more differentiation between companies. So there will be sectors and stocks that will derate, and there will others that will re-rate, and they're not necessarily going to be in accordance with a passive investment vehicle. So I'll definitely balance up my thought process between passive and active. If you are biased heavily in favor of one or t'other, actually, then you know, passive is always helpful, because what's the old line? The S&P 500 is always top quartile every year in the AI sector. We all know that, but in other markets that's not true. And I think particularly in likes of Japan, emerging markets, still Europe to a very good degree, very good momentum, and or trading style managers in Europe, and to a good degree in the UK, the same applies. So I think there is always opportunity, but my parting shot would be think more about active managers in this space, and actually just go for those stock pickers, the ones who are very obviously interested in trying to find the right stocks at the right price and then selling them when they get expensive. It's an old philosophy, but it's quite a good one.
And specifically within that, I mean, ETFs, how are they playing in all this?
If you want to have biases, then I suppose, fine, if you feel comfortable thinking you can buy some REITs in the morning in Japan and buy some others in America in the afternoon, then knock yourself out. But if you're a long-term investor, I think the other thing and trend for the decade, Roger, is going to be the dividend's going to matter. If we return in any shape or form to tradition, and the returns are 7 to 8 nominally, let's just call it that. That used to be, 60, 70% of that was coming from your dividend. So I think that's going to still play in a higher cost of capital world. The dividend is an expression of your capacity, not only to have better ROE, sweat your assets better, but also that you're in a position to provide your investors with a dividend. And I think that will have a degree of play moving forward in people's selections. I think you need to think about those income strategies. What were the bellwethers of most people's portfolios through the 80s, 90s, and even in the 2000s?
So it's interesting. I mean, just summing up as we come towards the end of this, you're essentially saying that the decision makers have to be more inventive, more active, more able to be fleet of foot, perhaps, in a way. The trends are not as clear as they were. Therefore, you have to be just that bit more on the ball.
I think within the confines of saying that growth still has a way to go versus value in terms of its relative rating, you also need to say that you're going to have to pick on the more flexible managers that have displayed an aptitude for investing through a cycle, understand what the difference in the cost of capital change has made, and try and find those good businesses, basically with good free cash flow, high return on equity, that know how to run their business as well. And that's across all sectors. It's not as simple as I'm going to buy house builders and buy five of them, or I'm going to buy all the banks. You know, it's not. You're going to have to be selective. And I think that's going to be the watchword for a while. And with the base of it is, I would look at keeping income as a base of what you do for the next few years, because I think it's the dividend's going to matter far more.
Yeah, that's interesting. The dividend issue is very clear in all this, isn't it? I mean, that if you like, is the flagpost coming out of all this, the thing we can say to look at.
100%.
Okay, well, it's very interesting to see this, and perhaps it's just a parting shot. Are you reasonably convinced that the trends that you've been talking about, I mean, we know there are so many variables out there. We know we don't know what's going to happen with the war. We've mentioned that. We don't know the consequences of it. Do you feel reasonably confident about knowing what's going to happen in the next 6, 12, 24 months, or do you feel less certain than you would have done, say, a year ago?
No, I think the overvaluation of the growth sector was ridiculous and egregious. Some of that's been unwound. I think it has further to go. I think the reassertion of good businesses win and bad businesses don't is also good. And I think the idea that you can build profitless prosperity, let's just remember, Tesla's been around a very long time. Just people forget. He's taken a long time to get here. This wasn't done over 3 years, was it? It's been done quite a long time to get to this point.
The point and changed a lot over that period. I mean, it's a very different company.
Exactly. So you from little acorns and all those good things, but you don't create disruptive businesses overnight. What was Amazon? A bookseller in 99. So even these well-honed, well-loved businesses have still taken decades to come to fruition. I'm not saying there aren't others out there, but it's really interesting to see what they might actually be, because you've sort of soaked the social media platform. You've sort of done the online thing. What's the next trend? Not obvious what it is. Isn't the iPhone 14 or whatever now is pretty similar to the iPhone 6? Not wishing to be a bit rude, but, you know, I've just changed my golf driver after about 11 years. Yes, I'm that good at keeping my stuff. And I'm telling you, I can't see that much difference.
There we are.
So that's the point. What is the next stage? I think it's the application of technology that applies to multiple businesses. That's more stock picky. Cost of capital is permanently up. No question that I'm absolutely convinced that's the case. Where am I wrong? They go back to QE. They go back there. That's an admission they failed. I don't think they're going to do that.
There we are. A golfing analogy is always a good point at which to say thank you very much indeed, Peter, for being with us. That is it from this episode of the Embark Pod. My thanks to Peter Toogood, Embark CIO. Fascinating discussion on, well, the shape of what's to come. I'm going to be back with more episodes of the podcast. I'm Roger Hearing. For now, thanks for listening and goodbye.